When I think about all my years in school, one of the most important moments, maybe the most important, the moment that made all other moments possible, came right near the beginning. And so I'd like to start off tonight with kind of a little public radio style sponsorship, if I might. This life is brought to you in part thanks to a serious cussing out by Mrs. Schlitz. This is In the Loop, and I'm Jeff Horowitz, coming to you from the UBS Forum here at Minnesota Public Radio. This is actually the second time I have officially acknowledged my second grade teacher. The first time was in a college entrance essay, and that is how important I think this moment was. And it had nothing to do with books, homework, tests, reading, writing, or arithmetic. I got in trouble for screwing around on the bus, and Mrs. Schlitz scared the crap out of me. I don't even remember specifically what I did. Teasing, yelling, roughhousing. Honest to God, my mind has created the memory, it's false, I think, that I got in trouble for doing impressions. That would be nice. Whatever it was enough to bring on a dressing down that totally blew my second grade mind. I got hauled off the bus into her classroom, and I left in tears. And from then on, I decided I was going to be a better kid. No more making fun of other kids. No more smarting off in class. No more wadding up wet toilet paper and throwing it at the mirror in the boys' bathroom. I admit it now, that was me. But I was done with it after that. Mrs. Schlitz turned me cold turkey. And tonight's show is about those lessons that you pick up in school, beyond what's actually in the curriculum. When pop quizzes and essay assignments are long gone, those lessons can be the lasting residue of those 13 years. Sometimes, like in my story, we can feel confident we've been changed for the better. And sometimes, well, you know, reflecting on our school years can lead us down a more cynical path.
It gives you a lot of practice trying to remember things that you're not at all interested in.
So the purpose of school is to teach you to follow rules so that you can interact with bureaucracies, which is an essential life function.
Honestly, I feel like it's also all about the schmooze factor. You know, you go to school to meet people who can help you get to better places. You tend to end up benefiting from the people that you meet.
Well, I learned, keep your head down, don't say anything, and like try not to get beat up, right? Like that's what I learned, and essentially that's the way I live my life now.
Those are some folks who joined us a few weeks ago to help set the theme for this show, and tonight we'll carry that conversation forward. We'll talk with students, young and old, about what they think they're learning, and hear from a family who decided school itself, the very idea of it, is a bad life lesson. We've got our own schoolhouse rock about the school system's roots in the Industrial Revolution, and a conversation about what students learn when their civil rights are abridged during school. You can hear our house band, The Smarts, behind me. Later on, they'll put their own musical twist on the topic. That's just the Cliff's Notes version of the show. We've got a lot more coming up over the next hour. So whether you're with us on the radio, online, on our podcast, or here in person, thank you for joining us in the loop. Broadcast of In the Loop is supported by Summit Brewing Company, makers of Summit Pale Ale and other fine beers. More information at summitbrewing.com. We are online at minnesotapublicradio.org/in-the-loop. There's a blog we post to almost every day, a new podcast every week, and an email list you can get on to learn more about the show if you like. All right, let's get this school day started. First period, homeroom. Here on In the Loop, we love hearing from kids. And when it comes to school, they really are the biggest experts, right? We're going to start off with some bushy-tailed elementary students from the Sheridan School in northeast Minneapolis. It's a magnet school for global arts and communications. And the students come from a wide range of economic and cultural backgrounds. When I asked what they were learning, I expected, you know, like little kid answers. Reading, math, arts and crafts. And they sort of answered that way, but with a very adult twist.
What would you say is the most important thing that you have learned in school this year?
I'd say writing, because in a lot of jobs you have to write things down, and in almost every job you have to go to at least one meeting, and you have to write down things on a document paper and things like that.
You're in third grade?
Yeah.
Well, you need math because some of these kids in the school are going to be working in an office, and they need to be typing numbers down in computers.
You also need to be really good at typing. Like, I've seen movies and stuff where they always have to recommend typing for certain jobs.
You guys are very job-focused.
Yes.
You're in third grade, fourth grade.
Yeah.
Do you think you should be worrying so much about what you need to do to get a job?
No.
Not really.
Not too much.
School more.
Not as much as we are.
Not really, because you have a long ways ahead of you.
Yeah.
But it's going to fly.
Time does fly.
Okay.
But not too much to worry about.
We should start worrying about jobs when we're at least in
middle school.
Because then we're going to be closer to college, and we're going to need a job to have, like, after college.
Well, you're going to need a job in high school to pay for college.
But sometimes in college you get a scholarship if you're doing good stuff, that they just give you the money.
What does homework teach you about what you need when you grow up?
It teaches you that you're going to need to do work at home even when you have a job.
When you think you have a break, you still have to do some work, too.
What is the point of school? Let's just go around here.
Education for the future. It depends on if you have a pleasant future, get lots of money, lots of friends and stuff, get married, blah, blah, blah. And then it decides if you don't get all that and you're poor and you live on the street and stuff.
Because once when you, like, out of school and you need your bills to be paid, you're going to have to get a job. If you don't have a job, that's not going to be good for you, because you ain't going to have no house, you're not going to have no car, and you're going to have nothing to give, except for you're just going to be poor.
Elementary students from Sheridan School over in Minneapolis. I'm wondering, is anybody else surprised to hear young kids offer up, like, future employment as the main reason for what they're learning in school?
Tara from Minneapolis. I think it's a little unfortunate. I don't know, somehow that aspect of culture, that paranoia that we have as adults as to whether or not we are going to make ends meet or whether or not we are going to move up is somehow, you know, pervading the elementary schools. It's very surprising to me. Very surprising.
Oh, right here. Yeah.
John from Blaine. I'm thinking, you know, when I was a kid, I was always thinking about what I wanted to do when I grew up. I wanted to be an astronaut or a fireman or something like that. And I think maybe the twist on it is that it's just become a little bit more practical. And I'm not sure if that's necessarily a good or a bad thing. I think it's good that kids want to have something to look forward to when they grow up. Maybe they're being conditioned in a way that our society may not deem as healthy, but people should be able to aspire to something, and hopefully it's aspiring to something noble.
I think this brings us pretty well to our second period of the school day, history. If our third graders are overly focused on the prospect of a job, maybe it has something to do with the way their school system was built over time. We started looking into it a little bit, and there is a certain historical pattern here. So, for our history lesson tonight, I thought we'd pay homage to a certain staple of Saturday morning TV viewing that tried to teach history, grammar, and civics to us Generation X kids. And I'm talking, of course, about Schoolhouse Rock.
Your schoolhouse rocking, a chip off the top of your favorite schoolhouse rock.
Jimmy, time to get up and go to school.
Aw, man, do I have to?
Absolutely, young man.
Hate stupid school. What's the point of school anyway?
Hello, Jimmy.
Who the heck are you? What'd you do to my bedroom?
Why, I'm Horace Mann.
The flute player?
No, that's Herbie Mann. I'm Horace Mann, often called the father of American education. And I've come from the 19th century to help you understand why you need to get your butt on that school bus.
Don't wanna.
Well, Jimmy, it's not about you. Schools were designed with something much bigger in mind. The national economy.
What?
Well, let me grab this guitar-like instrument here and take you on a little musical journey through history, Jimmy.
Oh, man.
Well, let me take you back, Jimmy, to the founding of the nation. Most American children got a private education. Parents at home, preachers at church, however they felt the groove. It was hard to control and inefficient for a nation on the move. Oh, well, Jimmy, let me introduce you to a man I'm sure you know. Thomas Jefferson had some thoughts on how to make the system grow.
We need two kinds of schools to help our nation be its best. One for a small group of future leaders, another for the rest.
Different systems for the learned and the laborers. That's what Jefferson said.
Gosh, I didn't know he said that.
Well, history is not your best subject, Jimmy. That's why you're in that second category. Oh, well, you know you gotta go to school so you can grow up and get a job. Big economies need worker bees, not another lazy slob. The nation needs a workforce, and schools have to provide. So you gotta get up and go to school so you can take your place with pride.
Golly, was school really designed around me being just some cog in the economy?
Well, think about it this way. We created a school system that trains you to respect authority, complete busy work you don't like, and hop to it at the sound of a bell. We even created evenings and summers off so kids can help out with the family business or farm.
Wow, a vestige of the agrarian society.
Whoa, let's be careful with those big words, Jimmy. You know the year was 1840, and the cities were overflowing. Immigrants came by the thousands, you see, and the need for schools was growing. While I was in charge in Massachusetts for a while, we led the way. We made sure those children were productive with their day. Yes, industrialists like Rockefeller offered some reflections. They weighed in with their money and political connections.
A school should teach kids order, to obey without a sound. We don't need more poets, artists, and philosophers around.
So you gotta go to school so you can grow up and go to work. A big factories need worker bees, not some artsy-fartsy jerk. You know the nation needs a workforce, and schools have to provide. So you gotta get up and go to school so you can take your place with pride.
Now, wait a minute. It's not like my teachers never encouraged me to be creative or have an opinion.
Well, of course there's a lot of room for flexibility. But we're still mostly stuck with this system forged during the Industrial Revolution. And if you don't believe me, take it from Andrew Carnegie.
Yep.
And there are more modern developments that reinforce our instinct to see schools as essentially workforce preparation centers.
Like the Smith-Hughes Act of 1917, which established the school as a federally funded location of vocational training?
Well, I think somebody's been cheating. Well, Jimmy, the year was 1983, and a new report we got put our students up against the world, and they didn't look so hot. The economy was in recession. How could we compete? The Japanese were kicking our butts back and forth across the street. Well, enter the age of testing, a new desire to standardize. You could tell the students dug it from the glaze upon their eyes. There'd be no child left behind, they all had to measure up. Math and science is the mantra to win the economic cup. Oh, yes, Jimmy, you got to go to school so you can grow up and take your place. Future companies need worker bees who can help us win the race. Come on, the nation needs a workforce, and schools have to provide. So you gotta get up and go to school so you can take your place with pride. That's right. You know you gotta get up and go to school so you can take your place with pride.
Jimmy!
Aw, you made me miss the bus.
I was joined there by Robin Johnson as Jimmy, and our bass player Joe Weissman as various historical figures, and of course, the Smarts. You're listening to In the Loop, and I'm Jeff Horwich. Since the song kind of brought us here, let's stay with this subject of testing. I read just this morning the nation's fourth graders have made some strides in standardized test scores. Some experts chalk this up to better reading skills. It just so happens we have a listener who spent some time grading the standardized tests of fourth graders. And it gives Adam Robinson a special vantage on the system. So we asked him to reflect on the experience for us. Adam, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'll let you take it from here.
Like most people in their post-college years, I was trying to make it as a rock and roll star, bouncing from one part-time day job to another. A friend of mine told me about this sweet gig at one of the big educational testing firms in town where you could make pretty easy money sitting at a computer all day grading answers from the written part of standardized tests. A short interview later, I settled into my first day of grading reading comprehension tests from every fourth grader in Ohio. It didn't take long for me to have my first doubts. During the first day of training, one of my fellow graders asked what the Rubicon for the test would be. What? Rubicon? I think he meant rubric. But as I soon learned, you didn't exactly need a PhD in English to do this job. See, the fourth graders had to read a short story about a brother and a sister who started at home and walked up a hill to their grandma's house to eat dinner. Then they had to turn the page and retell the story in their own words. After that, the test asked them to suggest what might happen next, after the story had ended. For that first retelling the story question, the kids just had to hit the main plot points to get a full 5-point score. Now, some kids were meticulous, essentially rewriting the story word for word. But other kids charted their own course, writing about visiting their grandmas or walking somewhere with their siblings. Some kids seized the moment to write amazingly creative essays about how they didn't know their grandmas, or how they were living with their grandmas, or how they were sure that their grandmas were certainly better cooks than the one in the story. I felt guilty, like I was grading the kids themselves, not the answers that they hurriedly scribbled into those test booklets. Was one kid's 6-paragraph essay about his complex relationship with his family really worth less than the kid who wrote, "A brother and a sister walked up a hill from their house to their grandma's house and then they ate supper"? Yeah. Yeah, it was worth less. 6-paragraph kid got 0 points. 1-sentence kid got all 5s. Now, there was a little wiggle room in the second question where the kids had to speculate on what happened next. I remember the trainer telling us that the kids' answers had to be reasonable, like the kids walked back down the hill and went to bed, or grandma gave them a big hug and told the kids that she loved them. I guess my standard for reasonable was just a little more flexible. I found myself giving fewer points to the kids who wrote entirely reasonable but thoroughly bland answers. And I rewarded kids who were creative or even outlandish. This one kid who wrote a long, elaborate essay about how kids got kidnapped by aliens and lived happily ever after on some remote planet in a different solar system got a smile and a robust 5 points from me. But it was really hard to flunk the kid who wrote a really interesting and insightful essay about prehistoric times while giving a perfect score to kids who did exactly what was expected by the test and absolutely nothing more. So one afternoon on my break, I saw my coworkers crowded around a bulletin board in the break room. It turned out that we, the graders, were being graded ourselves. I wasn't surprised to see myself near the bottom of the list. I knew that I was giving points for being creative and being harder on the kids who played by the rules. So over the next few days, I tried really hard to score the answers in ways that I thought the other graders would. And I noted the irony that now, as an adult, I too was trying to fit in just to get a good grade. But honestly, it was really difficult for me to do that. I was seeing myself in the answers of the kids who would show their fears or their hopes or their dreams or just show off that they loved language and they loved writing regardless of the question. I needed to reward those kids for those feelings. So at the end of the grading session, another list went up on that bulletin board. On it were the names of the graders who had the highest scores who would be hired back to grade tests again. This time, my name wasn't even on it. Honestly, I don't miss that job that much. It's probably a good thing that I didn't get asked back. But now that standardized testing is more prevalent than ever, my experience there makes me a little worried. I mean, it's one thing that we use these tests to measure if our kids and if our schools are succeeding or failing. But I wonder if standardized tests aren't also training kids at the same time, training them to play it safe, to not color outside the lines, and to not do more than we ask of them. I don't know about you, but I want to live in a world where having a grandma abducted by aliens is worth a full 5 points.
That's Adam Robinson. We're in touch with Adam because he's part of the Public Insight Network, folks like you who help create our show and share your knowledge for our news coverage as well. You can be part of the network by joining our email list at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. We had another connection to someone like Adam who is kind of inside and outside the system at the same time. Before we move on, I want to add his perspective to the mix.
My name is Brendan Curran, and I am an editor for high school literature textbooks. Certain states have these things called adoption committees, which are basically a group of people who review your textbook and either approve it to be sold in the state or say that it cannot be sold in the state. And they're looking for all sorts of criteria. One of them is objectionable material. Absolutely, sex and violence are the two, you know, hot button issues, the two things that we really have to look out for the most. I think if you're a student and you can't discuss sex and you can't discuss violence, if you're shielded from that, you sort of conceive of those two things improperly, you know, and that sort of ill-equips you to handle them when you encounter them in the real world. I mean, I think if you look at sort of historically seminal books, most of them, if not all of them, are things that are challenging the status quo. That's what makes it vital. That's what makes it alive. And, you know, yeah, that is kind of the thing that's being censored. It creates people who don't think critically, and it, to me, that's contrary to the whole point of education. I think the whole idea of educating your children is that you want them to be skeptical. You want them to ask questions. You want them to not accept an answer that doesn't make sense to them. It's a tough situation because you have to be able to sell your textbook. You have to be able to cater to the clientele. So sometimes you have to make compromises like that.
Now, you might be hungry for an example or two of what Brendan Curran is talking about here. Suffice it to say, those are considered trade secrets, what's in the books, and his company gently suggested he keep those to himself. Brendan's talking about this concept, not just in the textbook industry, that students are not quite ready for the real world, that school is a place where different rules apply. There may be good reasons for that, but it's still a controversial idea. This is a good time, I think, to leap into a new period of our school day, social studies. Is school a model of the real world, or an extension of home, where authority figures rule, like parents? You know, the Bill of Rights is, it's fair to say, abridged in schools. Freedom of speech, press, assembly, the Fourth Amendment's right to privacy, the Fifth Amendment's right to due process. We invited some folks here to help us think about this for a few minutes. First, Shane Davis, who's a senior at Central High here in St. Paul. Shane, you're deeply against military recruitment in your school, and I gather sort of the war in Iraq in general. Tell me some of the ways, briefly, that you've run into this rights issue in your school.
You encounter censorship as a student when you're trying to plan for things, put out flyers, but put up banners, or pass out information.
What's a specific example of a flyer that didn't fly?
Well, we'd plan for things such as walkouts. Well, you know, everyone walks out of school at a certain time and marches or meets up with a rally.
Sort of an invitation to skip school.
Yes, an invitation to skip school.
What about what you put on the flyers? I mean, your language? Just, are they watching out for that or what?
We had the word resist military recruitment on a petition, and it had to be changed to restrict, or we couldn't use the word stop. Anything that implied action, we couldn't use.
Let's move on to Eric. Eric Shaforjan, who's a senior at St. Francis High School in the city of St. Francis, Minnesota. Now, you've gotten a lot of attention in the past year as the editor of the school paper there over a photo that you wanted to publish. It's a picture of somebody ripping up a flag.
Yeah.
And what's the challenge you ran into with your administration at the school?
It started in January, and this photo of a girl holding up tablecloth bunting, it was to resemble a flag, was hung up in the Performing Arts Center hallway. This is during a fall play, the children's play. It showed a hypothetical takeover by a communist country. So that's what the picture was, and I took that picture. The picture was up for 6 weeks before the principal finally saw it during a staff social when he was setting up for one. And then they took it down without asking anyone.
What does this have to do with your newspaper?
I went into his office, and I said, well, we plan on printing a news story about you taking the picture down. He said, okay. I said, we plan on printing an editorial criticizing your decision. And he said, okay. And then I said, we plan on printing the picture. And that's when the picture got slammed on the desk, and I got yelled at. Do you want to be responsible for the bond not passing? Do you want to be responsible for the American Legion never giving funding to our school again? Do you want to be responsible for the school's image being damaged? That's where I went back to our advisor. It wasn't my class period. He followed me back to that room, yelled at me again, saying, get back to your classroom, and told my teacher, don't you have a job or don't you have a class to teach? Why don't you get in and teach it?
Well, let me say, there's an empty chair in between us here, you guys and myself. Both of your districts declined to send anybody to talk about this issue. In fact, Shane, your principal was arranged, the Principals Association in the state had arranged for her to come and talk about, in broad terms, the questions of student rights. And just as our show began, that offer was rescinded. So I'm going to have to crank it up a notch myself and pretend I'm Principal Horwich here and say, I'm trying to run a school here. I got to have kids learning. I don't need them distracted by flyers up telling people to get out of class. We need the bond referendum. That's more important than your rights. What do you say? You guys have been arguing this for months now in both of your cases.
We did ask some veterans. I asked my grandpa. Our advisor spoke to some people. I spoke to some people in our church, and they had said, well, I might not agree with the picture. However, when I was in the military, when I was in the Army, I was told this is what we are fighting for. In journalism, when you put a picture with an article, it's the picture that the article is talking about.
Well, I think in a high school setting, it's impossible to contain anything that kids want to get out. So every time a teacher would tell me to stop passing out the flyers, stop putting up this or that, it made our entire group just want to do it more, you know, or it only serves to like kind of fuel like the excitement about what we're doing. But you're supposed to, you know, learn a lot of different things in school. One thing is to learn how to handle free speech and how to handle being in a setting where there's so many different people from so many different places and all these different competing interests and
opinions and censoring anything, I mean, it's not going to work, first of all. And it's also just kind of an excuse to try to make less trouble for the administration.
When I was talking to the president of the State Association of Secondary School Principals, who at one point was set to come on this show and got sick this morning, one of the things that he said to me is, we are supposed to function as parents. You know, in parentis is a phrase that is used in this context. We're taking over for their parents during the day. That's how we see our role in terms of keeping their behavior on track. What do you say to that?
Well, I would say that I have parents. I don't need any more. When you're, and in high school, maybe elementary school, you need kids need more guidance. But when you grow up, you go to high school, it should be more about learning to take control of your own life and learning how to deal with consequences. You know, if you say something that is rude, you know, you say things that offend other students, it's better for you to learn how to deal with it through your peers than it is through censorship.
And Eric, you're going to get out of school. You're going to get these rights eventually. I mean, why do you need to exercise this in high school? You'll get there.
The school has this whole mission statement of preparing the students for their future. And yet we were threatened with legal action. Our funds were frozen and our teacher's job was threatened. I mean, teaching the students that, teaching me that this is the way to solve a problem isn't necessarily the way I think it should be. We're not sure if we're going to be shut down. We're all afraid to say what we want to say. Our newspaper hasn't printed a controversial story since January when this first happened. And now we're kind of living in this environment of being afraid and fear constantly.
Well, maybe they're preparing you for the real world all too well, then. I don't know. Playing hardball. Eric Shaforjan and Shane Davis, thanks both of you for joining us here on In the Loop. Remember those job-focused third graders from the start of the show? Well, I want to go back to Sheridan School in Minneapolis now. Because it's a K-8 school, I talked with some older kids there as well, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. The bright eyes and bushy tails were gone, replaced by kind of an adolescent slump. But it was good to see they had a little bit more worldly attitude.
What do you think is the most important, most useful thing that you've learned in school?
Even though it's the most annoying, math is still pretty good.
Time management. How to actually get everything done that I have to do in a day.
I'll say French because it's always good to know another language.
Communication by communicating with different races and cultures in the school because it's a very mixed variety of people. You learn more about communicating your feelings with other people.
Getting along with other races is good too because you gotta get used to life. It's like that diverse.
Apart from the education and the communication, it does teach you responsibility and it gets you ready for life because it's kind of like having a job. You have to go to school every morning at the same time and you have to do your job, do your work, everything, and then come home at the end of the day and do what you need for the next day. So it gets you prepared for what you're actually going to have to do when you're older.
You know, nobody likes school. I mean, some people do, but the majority is that nobody likes to wake up in the morning, get ready, do their homework, and then come to school and get more work and all. It does add up in the end, but sometimes it's like, can we be ourselves? Sometimes can we do what we want to do? We don't have to be grown up all the time.
Now, a lot of students ask that question. When do we have time to just be kids, to play and explore the world rather than study it all the time? And you know what? Some education reformers and parents worry about that, too. They worry that formal education, the very idea of going to school, drives out a child's innate love of learning as it tries to drive in knowledge and facts. That's led some parents to a trend called unschooling. It's capturing interest across the U.S. from New York City to Bemidji, Minnesota. And that's where we sent producer Sandon Totten.
It's one thing to homeschool your child. Parents become teachers and can download lesson plans, buy workbooks, or register kids for online classes. It's another thing to unschool your child. Kelly Trossett insists she's not the teacher for her three children.
One time I phrased it as a tour guide, but I thought that was kind of corny, but yet kind of true, because I kind of helped them along. And you know.
During the hours most kids are at school, Kelly's house is full of activity.
That's not it. There.
Her kids spend the day playing music, surfing the internet, reading, painting, or whatever else catches their fancy. You see, unschooling is about letting the child decide what to do and what to learn. For Kelly's 11-year-old daughter, Abby, that means studying piano, updating her blog, or reciting Shakespeare.
Double, double, boil in trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble.
That's from Macbeth. Abby read that when she was 9. She studied other classics, too.
What's the one with the ghost and Hamlet? Yes, everyone ends up dead. Gotta love it.
Abby says on any given day, she has dozens of interests. She'll wake up in the morning and start researching or writing or asking her mom about whatever's on her mind. Together, they'll look into one topic, but often end up studying something completely different. Abby's older brother, Alec, is much more focused. He delves into his studies for days at a time, sometimes staying up late in the night working out a single problem. He's only 14, but he has the determination of a graduate student. Except, he's not solving complicated math equations.
He won't give me an opening.
He's playing video games.
This game is so, there's so much in it. Now I've put a total of at least 300 hours into it.
300 hours? On video games? Most parents would cringe in pain at the thought. Spending months on Shakespeare is one thing, but playing World of Warcraft, Final Fantasy, and Halo 2? But that's part of unschooling. Kelly says if you tell your kids what they can and can't learn from, you'll shut down their curiosity. That's what she saw happening to Alec when he was in school. She says he was bored, depressed, that he was losing his drive to learn. So she pulled him out of the third grade. Since then, he's spent his time building massive Lego ships, studying Japanese samurai, and playing his Xbox. But Kelly says video games inspire Alec to learn about other things, too.
If you want to use school terms, geography, history, social studies, Alec has no time for mindless video games. I mean, it definitely has to be the problem-solving strategy to it.
Unschooling isn't a new idea. Thinkers from Socrates to Jean-Jacques Rousseau have touted the benefits of letting a child's interests lead their education. But it was John Holt who penned the term unschooling in the late 1970s. He inspired some families to abandon the school system for a looser approach to education. Recently, the idea has been catching on. Estimates are hard to come by, but within the roughly 1.1 million homeschoolers in the U.S., it's clear many are being unschooled. Unschooling message boards and listservs are springing up all over the country, some with several hundred members. But critics are on the rise, too. They say it's wonderful to think kids will soak up knowledge on their own, but that's not always the case.
That is the romantic notion. It was resurrected in the 60s for the hippies. Go out and everybody just make love and the world's going to be a beautiful place. Our experience is that isn't what happens.
That's Gretchen Wheelwright, a retired high school teacher, principal, and professor at Troy University in Alabama. She says unschooling is a disservice to children. She remembers public schools trying a similar approach in the 60s and 70s. Students could choose their own classes and work on self-directed projects.
You saw the results of this like 5 years, 10 years later. They didn't know anything. They had these vast gaps in their knowledge in areas they should have known.
Gretchen says even someone who loves to read Shakespeare needs to know math, science, and history. In states like Minnesota, children taught at home are required to take annual exams, but the State Department of Education never looks at the results. That makes it tricky for college admissions counselors. Yet some universities, like Stanford and MIT, have welcomed some of these unconventional students. Roya Sarushian says, for her, getting into college wasn't a problem. She's been unschooled since the fourth grade. She passed the high school equivalency exam at 15. Now, at 22, she just graduated from California State University at Long Beach. Roya says when she first started taking formal classes, she was amazed at the differences between her and her classmates.
I'd get homework and I'd go do it, and yet all the other students wouldn't do it at all, or they'd try to do the least they could. And I think that's because they're tired of school. They're tired of people telling them what's important for them to learn right now. I never had that.
Roya says her education gave her plenty of freedom, And that freedom is at the heart of unschooling. But still, many parents and educators wonder. Left to their own devices, will kids find their own internal compass and succeed in life? Or will many lose their way without the roadmap of a structured education?
That's In the Loop's Sandon Totten. Hey, it's lunchtime. Despite all the energy put into classroom instruction, we all know that this, the lunchroom, is where the real learning happens, right? It's where the curriculum ends and raw human nature takes over. The other day, I wandered out around noontime to a food court in downtown St. Paul. I wanted to see what adults remembered about how their lunchtimes worked.
Popular kids sitting somewhere and geeks sitting somewhere else.
Which table were you at?
The not super popular, but kind of the jockey, sort of popular table. There were different levels, you know. The 8, 9, 10 of popular. That was maybe like a 7.
I just remember our lunchroom being very clicky, and, you know, there was almost spaces on the tables between the different groups of kids that were sitting around.
But in a sense, that is the learning process, right? I mean, you get thrown in there, you act like jerks, you figure out what it takes to get along, what it takes to, you know, get on with people and what doesn't work and what does work, and then as a result, hopefully, at least the optimistic view is that when you go on to college or into the professional world, you have learned something about what it takes to be a decent person, and to socialize and everything else like that. So that cauldron of social dynamic maybe is what it's all about.
I think a lot of the people that in high school weren't considered popular got a jump on the people that were more into the group clickiness and things, realizing that, you know, they have to do things on their own because they don't have a group of kids to think as the group. They had to think on their own. So I think those people, probably if you look at them now, are probably more successful than some of the jocks and some of the people that were in the cliques.
I think it could be a brutal place to be because you had to be the in group, so kids could be isolated.
Do you think much of that stuff that goes on in school, in the lunchroom in particular, gets carried through to adulthood?
I think it can, because certainly having a class reunion coming up, you have some individuals who say, forget it, I'm not going to that class reunion. I remember my memories from school, and they weren't good.
Actually, we're a clique right here.
What's your clique?
Just some insurance nerds. The insurance nerd table.
And you could never go sit with the cool kids over there by the pizzeria.
Couldn't sit with the bankers, no.
So, how do all these adult memories check out against the modern-day social cauldron of, say, a middle school lunchroom? A seventh grader named Jasmine Robinson agreed to be my guide at Susan B. Anthony School in Minneapolis. I got there a little bit early, though, and we had to kind of hide around the corner for a few minutes. Why, you might ask?
The sixth graders are eating first lunch.
You don't really want to have anything to do with them?
I don't know. Like, it's fun to, like, say hi and kind of scare them, but I don't know. I just don't want to, like, go in there because it'll be weird.
Adolescent rule number one, seventh and sixth graders are completely, completely different, and don't try to tell a seventh grader otherwise. Beyond that, though, Jasmine says the cliques so many people remember from school don't really exist here at Anthony, in the lunchroom or anywhere else. But what do exist are very well-defined bands of friends. How big is your circle of girlfriends?
9 people, including me.
That's very clearly defined. 9 people. Does that number ever grow, shrink?
Actually, it's 8. Sorry.
It's 8. What happened to number 9?
She was just, like, talking about me in the summer, and I kind of got mad at her, and then so did everybody else. And we never really became, like, good friends again.
Well, Jasmine's 8 show up, and it's safe to go sit down now. No sooner do we get seated than my microphone and tape recorder start attracting the riffraff.
Billy, you guys leave!
You guys leave. That's so easy.
No, go.
Billy, move. Shoo.
You're shooing people away from the table?
Yeah.
Do you guys have to do that sometimes?
A lot of times.
Honestly, right now, a lot of people that are, like, over here, we probably wouldn't be talking to.
You might be thinking that Jasmine and her friends consider themselves the popular girls or that they're better than the other kids. They say that's not true, and I think actually they're telling the truth. It's just that seventh graders are very busy figuring out how to manage their social networks. Who's in, who's out, who's merely tolerable. They like their classes and all, but they say this is where they learn the real stuff they'll need later in life. And it's not always pretty.
Do people get teased at lunch?
Yeah. No one ever does it in front of you. They just talk about them when they're not there.
Yeah, they talk about them, and then someone else will tell the person what they said.
So what does that teach you think, about the real world?
People are going to talk about you, and you can't really do anything about it. That you can just try to be as nice as you can to everyone, but it's not going to help always.
Is this really important, or is school mostly just about going to class and doing your homework and teachers?
To me, it's like almost more important.
I think it's also like you find like who you are by like being at lunch, because in class you're learning about like math. You're not going to like figure out like who you are, your personality.
Everything isn't about math and science. It's about people. If there weren't people, you wouldn't have to go to school.
This is In the Loop, online at minnesotapublicradio.org/InTheLoop. And I'm Jeff Horwich. And, of course, I think we all know what comes right after lunch. Recess, right? Which seems like a good time to turn our audience loose here in the UBS Forum. I'd love some examples from you all of what you think schools are doing really well. And then on the flip side, what you think they're not doing so well at.
My name is Alex. I'm from Afton, Minnesota. I think schools are really great at giving everybody the exact same education. I think they're really great at trying to keep kids up to standard. What I don't think they're so great at is embracing the part of children that is not necessarily part of a standard. There's so much diversity in people, and if we're trying to squish that out so we can just focus on things that some people and some board decided were important, we're going to get a really unbalanced society.
Thank you. I think that's an excellent point. Anybody want to pull an example that they're aware of an educator, a teacher, or a school as a whole, trying to sort of reach out of these historical structures, reach out of the way schools have worked for decades? Sure, right up here.
My name's Sarah, and I live in Minneapolis. I think there are a lot of schools right now that are reaching out of the traditional. Off the top of my head, High School of Recording Arts, Avalon School, Community of Peace Academy. The whole point of the charter school law in 1991 was to give that leeway to people who have these ideas about what might be a better way for teachers to bring out that individuality in students. And so there are these charter schools all over the place now, all across the country, are really reaching out and saying, you don't have to fit into their mold, because you can come to us and we'll mold around you. Like, that's really the big thing that's going on right now.
Thank you. I want to harken back to the very opening of the show. I mean, the story that I told about this one moment that still stays with me, and I think, you know, through the course of my very early school years, managed to change everything that came afterward. Does anybody have any of those moments themselves that come to mind? You know, something that happened to you in school, an experience that you had that really, for better or for worse, shaped who you were from then on?
My name's Steve. I'm from Minneapolis. There was one day in high school during lunch, there's this huge commotion. All of a sudden, a couple hundred kids are all running, believe it or not, like as a giant horde across the school. It was a pretty amazing thing to witness. And I realized what happened is some idiot kid brought in some giant garter snake or something like that. It was running around with it, chasing an entire, you know, several hundred horde of people through a school. It's quite astounding. And it's also, like, totally ridiculous. And I had this perfect view of it, and the whole thing ended pretty gruesomely, and you could see him slamming the snake down on the ground, killing it, you know, instantly. It was an unbelievably violent act. Terrible thing to see. Now, I'll contrast that with another story. This happened same year, same school. Our lunchroom was self-segregated along race lines. So the white kids and the black kids always sat separately there. Some brilliant administrator at the school had the idea eventually to actually confront this, which is pretty courageous on his part. And they had this whole series of open forums and dialogues, and they actually confronted the issue dead on and talked about race relations. And in the days after those forums, believe it or not, the lunchroom de-self-segregated. It was, again, really astounding to witness. In that year, I saw sort of the best and worst of humanity in a microcosmic form in a school. And it gives you a window into what the adult reality is like waiting for you beyond that.
Thanks, Stephen. Before we move on, I want to bring someone specific out of our audience here to share one last story with us. When we called out for thoughts on the topic, what I really learned in school, Elizabeth Wickerin wrote us back with some vivid stories that we really enjoyed reading. So we asked her to put them together for us, and Elizabeth, welcome to In the Loop.
I learned a lot in school. I learned about mitosis, velocity, Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, World War II. All of these were eye-opening and worthwhile, and I wouldn't be the person I am without the vast and varied knowledge my free public education gave me. But they aren't the lessons that have stuck with me most as I've made my way in the grown-up world. One of those lessons came in sixth grade. That was the year my entire class tortured me. There was a ringleader, of course, but somehow she managed to get pretty much the whole class of 30 kids on her side. They threw food, punched me, called me names, chased me, blamed an all-school tater-tot food fight on me, and convinced a substitute that my name, Liz, was actually Les. Hormonal sixth graders can be very homophobic. That year I learned a lot of things about the world. I learned what cruelty looks like, and pity. I learned that adults are not all-powerful, and sometimes they just can't save you. I learned that books can serve as a best friend when you have none. I learned a fear of new people, and a healthy respect for the power of groupthink. When you get down to it, you learn most of your truly useful school lessons by the sixth grade. Reading, writing, all the math you'll ever need for your day-to-day life. As a stay-at-home mom and a pizza delivery driver, I rarely find a use for my in-depth knowledge of the steps of cell division. But I draw every day on one class I took in high school, an elective course called Life Skills. We learned things like how to do laundry and balance a checkbook. Over the long term, it was probably the most valuable class I took. I find it funny that my school required me to learn how to put a condom on a banana and dissect a frog, but considered it an elective to learn how to look after your personal finances. Now I find myself on the cusp of the educational cycle starting anew. My 5-year-old son starts kindergarten in the fall. Will things be different for him? Inevitably they will. First of all, he's going to a Catholic Montessori school, a place where things like grace, courtesy, and kindness are in the curriculum. I hope he won't have to learn about meanness the same way I did. He already goes to preschool there and enjoys working on activities labeled practical life, learning how to wash dishes, sweep, and make biscuits, skills I know he'll use later on. But when he gets a little older, and he does need help with his biology homework, I'll be there, waiting to pass on my knowledge of mitosis.
That's In the Loop listener and now contributor, Elizabeth Wickerin. Along the way so far, we've heard from elementary students and middle schoolers. Now I want to get some high schoolers into the mix, seniors who are just on the verge of jumping into the real world. So let me introduce the students that I have with me. Basanti Miller has been taking lots of college prep classes at South Liberal Arts High School in Minneapolis and is headed to the University of Minnesota. Next to her, we got Dan Karras. You're graduating from Humboldt High School in St. Paul, where Dan's been focusing on vocational skills. After school, he's got a full-time job waiting for him with his family's waste management business. And we also have Raji Eid, who's graduating from the Area Learning Center here in St. Paul, which is a place for students who struggle with regular high school. And he's hoping to go on to St. Paul Technical College in the fall. Let's talk about school a little bit. You guys have just wrapped up, what, 13 years of this. Was it worth it?
Well, yeah.
Raji, yeah? You went through some really rough years there.
Yeah.
Was it worth going through that? I mean, is that of a value in itself, fighting through those kind of awful years of high school for you?
Now, yeah. I mean, now I look back on it, it was a good thing now because I'm doing better now. But at that time, it was horrible.
So. What do you think you picked up from those years, the tough years?
Don't backtrack. Just, leave the past in the past. And when I was, like I said, when I was in there, I didn't really learn much. That's how I felt because I was in a big classroom about 35 to 40 kids, and I wasn't getting the one-on-one attention that I needed. So it was kind of difficult for me to learn. I had to make a move.
Now, Dan and Basanti, are you coming out of school thinking,
This was like, I couldn't have been doing anything better with my time.
Not exactly.
No?
So I just believe it's what you make of it. I used to go to Crete and Durham Hall, and you know, it's supposedly top of the top schools. Well, I hated it. My focus wasn't there. My schoolwork wasn't there. I went there for 2 years, and I was miserable. And I live right across the street from Humboldt High School, and that's where I wanted to go. I knew all the kids from grade school and everything, and I made that switch from my junior and senior year. And now I'm going to graduate from there, and it's been the best 2 years of my life. I couldn't be more thankful for what the teachers have done. I've had more of like a one-on-one relationship with them. I've never been more prepared and never been more happy with my decision.
Now, Dan and Roger, you guys are both talking about, you know, decisions that you made yourself that are the fundamental feature of your high school experience. Basanti, do you feel like you were able to just sort of ride the wave here of the way school works and now you're headed off for great things?
Definitely not. I would have to agree with both of them when they said that you have to take an initiative and get what you need out of your own education, because a school system, especially, I go to a really large public school, South High, there's about 3,000 kids. You just get lost in the mix of it so quickly and so easily. And, you know, 30 kids in a classroom, there's not a lot of one-on-one with teachers. And I've definitely had to go outside of my comfort zone, get comfortable with myself, and then go talk to teachers and get involved and pick and choose what I want to learn and what I don't want to learn and that kind of thing.
Now, put aside what you were taught in your classes. Do you guys feel socially like you're ready for life? Like you know how to deal with people, how to handle tough situations?
I think that part of school is more on the student almost. Like, there's only so much a teacher can teach you. He can't teach you how to make friends, really. You have to kind of take that initiative and that step.
How about you guys? Are you ready for the rough and tumble world of adult relationships of all kinds?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, once you go through high school, you learn a lot of things like dealing with people, you know, good people, bad people, teachers.
Which category are they in?
Teachers. Yeah, you know, you learn a lot of things dealing with people. So it's like when you get out there, you shouldn't really be, you know, really surprised by anything, really. I mean, unless you're going to work and, you know, whatever. But other than that, when you're going to meet people no matter what, it's just, you know, whatever happens to you is just on you, you know, how you're going to deal with it. And that's really how I see it.
You guys have all come out of public schools. Do you get the sense that one system, one pattern can handle all three of you?
I feel like as long as we as individuals let the school systems know what we need, that we can get what we want out of it. But as a whole, they're not going to necessarily cater to all three of us among all the hundreds of thousands of students out there.
All of your stories had a lot to do with personal initiative, I guess. Sounds like a good lesson. Well, Raji Eid, Basanti Miller, and Dan Karras, thanks very much for joining us here on In the Loop. Well, what do you know? It's time for last period. Music class seems like a nice one to end our school day with, I think. I asked the Smarts, our house band, to think about what they really learned in school. And Joe Weissman, you wrote this next tune. What was it that jumped out for you?
Well, after 7 months of having to write pop songs about things like North Korean diplomacy and voter apathy, I decided to take advantage of the topic, what I really learned in school, by writing a song about relationships and dating.
Finally, a relationship song. You've been after this all along. Well, the Smarts are Joe Weissman playing guitar for this tune, Jimmy Kennedy on keys, Morris Engel on drums. I'm going to grab on to Joe's bass for this next tune, something they called Teacher of the Year.
I've had the teachers who did what they could, and ones who bored us all to tears. I've had the kind that tried to be your pal, reliving their own glory years. But so few made a deep impression, though. That's where you put them all to shame. I learned so much and in such little time. you're the one who's to blame. Yeah, you're the one who told me everything I ever really need to hear. If asked, you'd get my nomination for the freaking teacher of the year. Taught lessons how not to care. Self-doubt, self-loathing, and self-consciousness. I learned a lot about myself. So in appreciation, I submit my nomination. You were mine, were mine. Wisdom is something to earn, but these are things I'll look back on in time. More than my class, sports, or fear. If I think little else about this time, I'll still be teacher of the year. For your consideration, turned in my commendation. You were mine, were mine.
Broadcast of In the Loop is supported by Summit Brewing Company, makers of Summit Pale Ale and other fine beers. More information at summitbrewing.com. In the Loop is online at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. Special thanks tonight to Andrea Eiten, Ross Bennett at Minneapolis Public Schools, and Casey Mahon in St. Paul. Volunteers make our live show happen here in the UBS Forum. Christina Schmidt, David Jonas, and Molly Bloom helped us out tonight. Jeremy Pavlek is our photographer. Our engineers are Josh Kubasta and Michael Osborne. The live producer of In the Loop is Alan Freckman. Our assistant producer, Sandon Totten. The executive producer of In the Loop is Michael Scholar. I'm Jeff Horwich. Thanks, everybody, for being here. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next month.